Iran slams Israel's outrageous allegations against Tehran, saying such remarks are aimed at deflecting attention from the regime's atrocities in the region. Israel's Prime Minister submits a bill to dissolve the parliament after his coalition cabinet collapses, paving the way for the regime's fifth elections in 3 years. Also ahead, Russia's former president dismisses nuclear arms reduction talks with the US as pointless, saying Moscow should wait until the Americans beg for negotiations. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Iran slams Israel's, quote, outrageous allegations against the country, saying the regime wants to deflect attention from its atrocities in the region. Iran's UN ambassador says Israel is infamous for its racist policies and hate speech and cannot hide this fact through propaganda. Majid Takht Ravanchi was responding to anti-Iran allegations by Israel's representative at a UN meeting marking the first International Day for Countering Hate Speech. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian envoy warned against the growing trend of Islamophobia, saying such tendencies lead to violent extremism and threaten the security of all societies. He cited the politicization and restriction of the hijab, the burning of the Holy Quran, and the desecration of Islamic symbols and holy sites in some countries. Takht Ravanchi blamed this situation on anti-Muslim media outlets and civic groups promoting Islamophobia in the West. He also lamented the lack of resolve on the part of certain governments to confront hate speech and acts of hate against Muslims. Iran's armed forces have warned the U.S. of irreparable blows in case of any strategic mistake against the country. The spokesman for the forces downplayed the February flight of U.S. B-52 bombers over the Persian Gulf, describing the move as a show. Brigadier General Abul Fazl Shekarchi also said Israel's recent measures in the West Asia region are out of desperation. Israel's Minister for Military Affairs has said that Tel Aviv is developing a joint defense system in cooperation with some regional Arab states to thwart what he called the threat of Iran's drones and missiles. Benny Gantz said the regime will pursue the plan under U.S. leadership. The leaders of Israel's fragile coalition cabinet are set to submit a bill to dissolve the parliament, paving the way for the fifth general election in 3 years. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett and his foreign minister Yair Lapid made the announcement in a Monday statement. The regime's top officials admitted that the decision came after all options to keep the coalition cabinet failed. The bill, which will be submitted next week, will make Bennett the regime's shortest-serving premier. Lapid will take over as the interim premier until the next election, which is scheduled for October 25th. Israel's fragile eight-party coalition was formed in June 2021 after four successive inconclusive elections. It lost its majority in Israel's parliament in April when a member of Bennett's Yamina party announced her departure. In Syria, a terrorist attack on a civilian transit bus has killed at least 13 people and injured three others. Syria's defense ministry says the attack happened on a road linking the city of Raqqa to Homs. The ministry says 11 troops and two civilians were killed. Three other soldiers were also wounded. Daesh has claimed responsibility for the attack. The terrorist group was in control of large swathes of land in Syria until a few years ago, but has since lost almost all of that territory. However, the group's sleeper cells are still active in the Arab country. They have carried out several attacks over the past months, leaving dozens dead or wounded. June the 20th marks World Refugee Day. For Palestinians, the day is an occasion to review a history of displacement, dispossession, and suffering under Israeli occupation. We were earlier joined by our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, to get a picture of the situation of displaced Palestinians.
World Refugee Day is another reminder for the world about the suffering of refugees in general and Palestinians in particular. They've been displaced and dispossessed for more than 74 years. On May 15th, Palestinians marked the 74th anniversary of Nakba Day, of the day of catastrophe, referring to the displacement, disposition, and massacre of Palestinians in 1948 upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Currently, there are 6 million registered Palestine refugees around the world, according to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. But Palestinians say that the number is much higher because not all Palestinian refugees and their descendants have been registered with UNRWA. Gaza is home to more than 1.3 million Palestinian refugees out of a population of nearly 2 million. The suffering is much higher in Gaza. They've been under blockade since 2007. They have faced 4 Israeli wars since 2008.
Turning elsewhere, Russia has dismissed nuclear arms reduction talks with the U.S. as pointless, saying Moscow should wait until Washington begs for negotiations. The comment was made by former president and current deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev. He said there is no need to negotiate nuclear disarmament with the U.S. yet, adding that it was bad for Russia. Medvedev said everything is now at a dead zone between Washington and Moscow, as the two countries, quote, don't have any relations. As Russia's president, Medvedev signed New START in 2010 with then-US President Barack Obama. The treaty was extended in 2021 for 5 years. Fears of a renewed arms race are now on the rise amid critically low relations between Moscow and Washington over the war in Ukraine. Russia and the US are the world's biggest nuclear powers, which control about 90% of the global atomic arsenal. And the Russian military presses ahead with its operation to take the eastern region of Donbass. In the latest development, Russia and its allies have made advances in areas near the flashpoint city of Severodonetsk. Pro-Russian forces say they have gained control of the town of Toshkivka. Kiev has confirmed that. It has also acknowledged reports that Russian forces have captured the settlement of Met Yolkin on Severodonetsk's eastern outskirts. Kiev says Russian forces have stepped up their shelling in Donetsk as well as Kharkiv in the northeast. President Volodymyr Zelensky says he expects Russia to intensify its attacks as Ukraine awaits the European Union's decision on its candidacy bid. EU leaders will discuss Kiev's membership at their summit this week. The country applied to join the bloc just a few days after Russia launched its war on February 24. In other news, barely 2 weeks ago, the British Prime Minister survived a potentially lethal challenge to his leadership. Boris Johnson narrowly made it through the Conservative MP's vote of no confidence in the House of Commons. And yet, Johnson has decided to take on new challenges instead of talking about the Partygate scandal and his actions during the coronavirus pandemic.
Considering the latest controversies around Johnson, the British Prime Minister seems to be taking full advantage of a strategy known as the dead cat strategy in order to divert media attention away from problems or failures in other areas. Just a week after the vote of confidence, the British Prime Minister and his government are provoking other crises. Johnson says he wants to focus on what the people of the country want. And the first two issues which he has decided to tackle are the controversial matters of changing trade rules for Northern Ireland and flying refugees to Rwanda, both cases that thrust Britain into a nasty web of legal disputes that risk making the country look like an international scofflaw. With his leadership in peril, Johnson summoned his trusted advisors, and among those experts is political strategist Linton Crosby, a master of so-called wedge issues that divide national opinion. Such strategies are typically used to galvanize working-class voters. The most divisive wedge issue is asylum seekers, as Crosby clearly demonstrated in his experience with the Australian premiership, winning him many victories some two decades ago. So it wasn't a coincidence that a few days after their meeting, Home Secretary Priti Patel's floundering plan to export asylum seekers to Rwanda was revived. But at what cost has the British Prime Minister risked turning the UK into a pariah?
The controversy surrounding it is becoming more of a legal battle. We have seen the European Court of Human Rights intervening in the issue based on, you know, filing from some of those affected by the decision, some of the asylum seekers. And I wonder if the UK really became a pariah state under Mr. Johnson, because this is not the first time he is going against international law.
The chartered Boeing 767 booked to take asylum seekers to Rwanda was a fiasco. It didn't take off thanks to a last-minute intervention from the European Court of Human Rights.
So the UK has, in essence, thrust itself against the European Court of Human Rights on the Rwanda Agreement, which stipulates that refugees to Britain will be deported to the African country and undergo their asylum procedures over there. The controversial £120 million deal is coming under heavy criticism with regards to its legality.
The British government's first attempt of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda came to a halt on Tuesday after the European Court of Human Rights intervened and forced the UK to abandon the flight. The intervention has, however, drawn frustration from British ministers who insist the plan was lawful. Britain's failed attempt has also led to officials proposing alternatives that would allow the UK to ignore the ECHR. Johnson himself defended the plan, saying it was completely legal.
Every single court in this country said, you know, there was no obstacle that they could see. Nobody in this country, no court in this country, ruled the policy unlawful, which was very, very encouraging.
Johnson described the order by the European Human Rights Court to stop the scheduled deportation of a handful of migrants as a weird last-minute hiccup. The United Nations refugee chief has, on the other hand, called it catastrophic. Following the ECHR's decision, British courts now have to clarify whether this practice is lawful.
When it comes to the issue of asylum seekers being exported by his government out of the UK to Rwanda, 1,000 miles away in Africa, that's actually illegal. We have heard this characterization of the issue as illegal from the United Nations, the Human Rights Commission, from multitude of international rights.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his government have spent much of this week battling with the EU and rowing with the European Human Rights Tribunal while playing down accusations that they are breaking international law and bow to the base of his party. On Monday, Johnson's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss revealed the long-awaited Northern Ireland Protocol Bill, a bill which, if passed, would allow the UK government to unilaterally cancel parts of the Brexit deal he struck with the EU in 2019. 2 days later, the EU reacted by launching legal action against the UK for its failure to implement parts of the protocol to date, while the Vice President of the European Commission stated that there is no legal or policy justification whatsoever for unilaterally modifying an international agreement. That is illegal. But the Prime Minister's willingness to have public spats with large international institutions seems typical of him. The Rwandan deportations and the renewed issue of Northern Ireland just seem to be radicalization of British politics, where Johnson tries to stay in power with new crisis.
Turning elsewhere now, Belgian police say tens of thousands of people took part in a march through Brussels on Monday demanding government measures to offset record high inflation. This is while the European Union comes under mounting pressure for spending billions of euros on arming Ukraine at a time when the bloc's citizens are struggling to make ends meet. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Tens of thousands of union members marched through Brussels city centre on Monday, calling for more support to deal with the cost of living, which is rising by the day. Inflation in Belgium has hit 9%. The Eurozone average is 8.1%.
The prices of electricity, water, all the supplies are going up, and the wages stays the same.
I have a bill to pay 6,000 euro for gas and electric. That's not normal.
All the other costs are very high. Energy, electricity, gas, but also food.
It's cheaper if I stay home than if I go and to work. That's not good.
The demonstration was organized to coincide with a national one-day strike.
Belgium has been brought to a standstill by this strike. Trains, trams, metros and buses are not operating. All of the departing flights from the main airports in Zaventem and Charleroi have been cancelled, impacting an enormous number of passengers, including would-be holidaymakers.
Western nations are sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro. Those on strike insist there is too much emphasis on war and not enough on diplomatic negotiations.
There is a NATO rule which says that each country has to invest 2% of their budget on military stuff. I think this is completely useless.
They have money to send to Ukraine for sophisticated weapons. It will cost a lot. And they say they don't have enough money to support us.
All of them, they just have blood on their hands. I think that's the real problem. And high society who is just making profit of all of that.
Unions in Belgium are warning of more strikes during the summer if the national government and EU authorities fail to ease cost of living pressures. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that report brings an end to the World Bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra. an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I am now in my grandma's small yard. My grandma has gone on a trip to visit her relatives. Therefore, I'm here to water her plants. I love this small, beautiful yard. In this yard, there is a berry tree, a cherry tree, and a cypress, as well as red roses, petunias, and the shrub of night-blooming jasmine. These plants are abundant in Tehran and Alborz provinces, especially in the villages and suburbs around. Let's go to Shahristanak village today. This village is so beautiful and has really unique weather. I'll set off to this village after watering my grandma's plants. Shahristanak village is located in Asara rural district in Alborz province. This village is situated 55 kilometers northeast of Karaj, between Tehran and Alborz provinces. This village is 2,190 meters above the sea level. It's cold in winter and mild and pleasant in summer. A river which carries a huge volume of water passes through the village and pours into Karaj River. Shahristanak is a historical village. Nasiruddin Shah Qajar used to have a special palace in this village. The historical relics remained show that this village dates back to 6th century AH. Some of the historical relics in this village include Dozd Band Castle, Shensotun Hill, Nasiri Palace or Shahristanak Palace. And I am now in Shahristanak village. I'm standing by a very beautiful river, which its sound you can hear. Here is full of berry and cherry trees, which have no fruits at this time of the year. However, birds have perched on the branches of these trees and are singing charmingly. Oh, no music is attractive as what we hear in the nature. Don't you agree with me? And I am now in Shahristanak Palace. This palace was built in 1896 by the order of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar. Unfortunately, most parts of this beautiful palace have been damaged. Almost nothing has remained from the second floor of this building, though you can guess how beautiful this building used to be. Oh, look, this is a really big piece of rock. I think it's over 4 meters high. There are some carvings on this rock which cannot be read at all. By an old, huge cypress tree. Cypress is one of the ancient symbols of Iran. There are ancient cypress trees in almost every city in Iran. The height of this cypress tree is 17 meters, and it has a giant trunk. Oh, this tree is really pretty. I can't take my eyes off it. Oh, well, I'd like to sit beneath this old tree and lean against its trunk. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Well, this is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Viewpoint, and here I am your host. This is Asma. And I'm very pleased to have two very dear guests, Brother Ali and Sheikh Ruhollah. Well, utopia, utopia, utopia. Everybody talks about it. Everyone has an imaginary place in their mind in which everything is just so pitchy and perfect and there is no error and everybody is an angel. Does such a place really exist?
Should we start with that? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To reach to this answer, it actually requires some introduction and introductory steps to go to say that such a thing exists or does not exist. But we can talk about that. We can talk about this issue that it was among the important issues and concerns of human being from the, let's say...
Ancient ages.
From ancient ages, from the, let's say, scholars of the Greeks till today. And it has been in their works and literature, and it has been seen. But we are all hoping to reach to such a, let's say, utopian government and utopian city.
So now, Sheikh Ruhollah, I would ask you... Everybody talks about utopia, and we believe that the promised Imam, Ajalallah Farajah, would come, and that utopia would emerge in some levels. But then, how to achieve that utopia? As citizens of utopia, do we have any responsibilities? Can we help that utopia to be created?
Of course, as much as we could. We have to play our own role. We have to fulfill our responsibilities in regards with the reappearance of Imam Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance, inshallah. So I think that utopia, if it would be established by the Imam, It needs a certain type of, tools, equipment, and means by which a specific sort of knowledge, specific sort of power that Imam should have, to establish that kind of system, an ideal sort of political system, economic system, social system.
And the most important part of those tools is human beings. The people who are living in that society.
The people should support, the people should help. But I think since we believe that the Imams, alayhim salatu wasalam, they have a kind of specific or special sort of knowledge that they receive from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and this knowledge is transmitted from the Prophet to the Imams. So that knowledge, that specific kind of knowledge would help the Imam to establish that sort of system. Otherwise, by this limited, ordinary knowledge that we have, or the leaders have, the kings have nowadays, even the experts or the professionals had, they cannot establish that sort of perfect sort of system. I think that's why Imam is a special kind of figure, a special kind of personality. He's not like other people.
Yes.
That's why we are following the Imams. If the Imams are like other people, then why should we follow them? Why should we actually trust them? And why should we listen to them? Why should we obey them? So since the Imams and the Prophets are special kind of people that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bestowed upon them, special sort of knowledge, special sort of, capacities, capabilities.
Direct link to God.
Of course, yeah. So that's why they are able to do that, to actually brought a kind of ideal sort of society, ideal sort of place that people would enjoy a better life in this world. So that is as much as it is possible in this physical and material world. Of course, that perfect and idealistic sort of or imaginary sort of utopia that some people might have in their own minds, of course, that might not be even possible to be made or to be established in this physical world. So Imam will be able to brought a better life to the extent that is possible
in this world.
In this world, yeah. That's it.
That is applicable to this world.
But of course, that level of life or that kind of systems that he will establish, of course, it is not comparable
with
the
other. Would be the utmost that would be possible
exactly,
in this
exactly.
world.
Exactly. That is something that has never happened. And the other people are not able to do that. So again, that is ideal. That is the super sort of kind of system and the highest level possible. But of course, it has not happened. No other, people, societies throughout
history has never seen that.
Never seen that, never experienced that. So that's why that is an utopia, of course. Yeah.
So the requirement of that utopia.
In that ideal and utopian society, we are expecting the social, economic security as well. As I said, I was talking about security, but economic security is also of importance. And people find their economy flourish.
Actually, it does not happen over one night. It's not just something that miraculously everything is going to change. I guess the people also are going to have such features in them that they are ready to all the changes that is going to happen.
Look, with the appearance and advent of Imam, people get more matured with Imam's presence, actually. With the presence of Imam himself, actually, people get mature and reach. And in Hadith, we have, in case they have learned two letters of word of knowledge at the time of appearance of Imam, if this will reach to 27. So two out of how many? 27 have been just learned. So the rest will come to us with appearance of Imam. So it means that his own appearance is meaningful.
A whole lot of change.
So his own appearance is meaningful. So why we are talking about the economy and organizing the economy of the people, the economy of the world is going to grow. The reason is that Islam actually pays attention to different parts of human being. Not only the material life,
but also to the spiritual part of him.
Exactly.
See, so these are of importance. And the lesson of, I think, one of the most, let's say, characteristics of Mahdavi utopia is perfection of mind and rationality. Look, in our hadith, in our Islamic sources,
and
from even the Quran.
How does that happen?
Yeah, inshallah, we'll get to that. The intellect has an important role. Look, whatever we are asked as the duty bound, we are asked and we are told that, okay, based on your intellect, based on your understanding, do this and do that. So Allah bestowed you a prophet, a real prophet that comes from the side. Actually, the revelation comes to him, and you have an inside yourself, a prophet inside yourself. So the prophet which is inside yourself is your intellect, is your mind, that you think with that. So intellect understands that with the appearance of this noble existence, all these goodnesses comes to you, then what are all for? Just to get perfected, to reach to this perfection. So we see, inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. So all these introductions are for us to be a good servant of God. In
exactly.
A utopian city, when everything has been given and every blessing has been actually bestowed and
fulfilled,
then you are asked to be a good servant of God, to do your servitude, to actually be.
There's only one goal after everything.
That's when the mind is getting perfected. Then you know, okay, who deserves to be to be worshipped, and this is only God. And Allah is the one who actually deserves to be perfect. Because He gave you whatever you needed. He gave you all the blessings. He gave you security. He gave you actually dignity. He gave you justice. He gave you whatever was your immediate needs actually are presented.
All what you mean is that during that time, we are going to have that awareness that the only person who is suitable for worshiping is God.
The outcome of the result of all the result of all these things in the world is just to reach to this point that okay, this is Allah who deserves to be
the worthiest
worshiped.
Of all.
Yeah, because when our mind or intellect gets perfected,
it's going
when
to
our
get wider.
Comes to its highest level, like the infallible people actually reach to this highest level that they understood who deserves to be actually worshipped. We, in our worship, even the believers, even the believers in higher levels, the difference is here between the infallible and not infallible people. They actually understood in the highest sense of it that Allah is the one who deserves to be worshipped. But ordinary people and believers have some way out to reach to that point.
Yes, very true. So now, just the point that you mentioned, but I'm going to ask Sheikh Ruhollah about how does that happen? How this readiness happens? I mean, people wake up and everything is solved?
Mm-hmm. You mean that for the people that now we have them, what will be happening for these
yes,
people?
Yes, what happens to them?
Mm-hmm. You know, when they see, when the imam reappears, so there are certain things that are mentioned in riwayat and hadith that's happening when the imam reappears. But we are not going to talk about this kind of things, but what is going to be established, I mean, the system that is going to be established by the imam, that is important. And since, as it was rightly mentioned by Brother Alavian, that imam is infallible, so an infallible person make no mistake. So once you make no mistake, so you will bring us the best possible kind of system or lifestyle, or let's say, you can provide us with the best possible sort of society.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's a kind of ideal society that the imam will brought us with. Then
that's the part that goes for the leader.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, that is for the leader. Now the citizens.
Yeah, when it comes to the people, and the people also, you see, are in need of such kind of leaders. So the leader has the main role to guide the people, to lead the people, to tell the people and order the people what to do, what not to do. What is the role of the people? So we do not know now our roles. So the imam will tell us at that time that, okay, it's your responsibility is this society's responsibility, but this community should do that. So that class of people or category of the people should do such and such. So these are the things that will be ordered by the imam, and the people should follow the imam. And finally, we will have the result of this obedience of the imam.
So this is what happened. Thank you. It was such a nice session. I enjoyed it a lot. We talked about utopia, and inshallah, in immediate future, we would see a day in which the promised imam would come and reappear. Inshallah. And in that society ruled by him, there would be justice flourishing everywhere, and there would be no poverty, and all the great ideals of Islamic world would be fulfilled. Thank you for listening.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I, when I have you, to doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In Georgia, United States, David Perdue challenged Governor Brian Kemp because of Donald Trump's fury over his 2020 election loss. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Reed Epstein and Shane Goldmacher. The piece is titled, "Perdue Had Trump, in Georgia, Kemp Had Everything Else." In September of 2021, former Senator David Perdue was hemming and hawing about running for governor of Georgia. Over dinner with an old friend on Sea Island, he pulled out his iPhone and showed the list of calls he'd gotten from Donald J. Trump, lobbying him to take the plunge. He said Donald Trump called him all the time, said Martha Zolla, a former aide to Mr. Perdue, who now hosts a talk radio show in Gainesville, Georgia. Martha Zolla added, he showed me on his iPhone these multiple recent calls and said they were from the former president. Martha Zolla and a legion of other former Perdue aides and advisers told the former senator that running was a bad idea. He listened to Donald Trump instead. Now David Perdue is staring down an epic defeat at the hands of Governor Brian Kemp, the Republican whom Donald Trump has blamed for his 2020 loss, more than any other person. The Perdue campaign is ending the race low on cash, with no advertisements on television and a candidate described even by his supporters as lackluster and distracted. Perdue thought that Trump was a magic wand, said Newt Gingrich, the former House Speaker and a Trump ally, who was among David Perdue's highest-profile Georgia supporters. In retrospect, it's hard to understand David Perdue's campaign, and it's certainly not the campaign those of us who were for him expected. Mr. Perdue's impending downfall in Tuesday's primary for governor in Georgia looms as the biggest electoral setback for Donald Trump since his own defeat in the 2020 presidential election. There is perhaps no contest in which the former president has done more to try to influence the outcome. Mr. Trump recruited, promoted, and cleared the field for his ally while assailing Brian Kemp, recording television advertisements and giving $2.64 million to groups helping David Perdue, by far the most he has ever invested in another politician. Yet the race has exposed the limits of Donald Trump's sway, especially against entrenched Republican incumbents. David Perdue's failures were not just of his own making. He was outflanked by a savvy incumbent in Brian Kemp, who exploited the powers of his office to cut off David Perdue from allies, including Mr. Perdue's own cousin, Sonny, a former governor and Trump agriculture secretary, whom Brian Kemp's allies appointed chancellor of the University System of Georgia. Governor Brian Kemp also appeared to punish those who crossed him. One congressional seat was drawn to exclude the home of a candidate whose father, a Perdue supporter, had publicly criticized the governor. And he offered goodies to voters, including a gas tax holiday that conveniently runs through to the end of May, just past the primary. On Thursday, 19th of May, as David Perdue campaigned outside the Semper Fi Bar and Grill in Woodstock, Georgia, he was not conjuring up a path to victory, but haggling over the scope of his widely expected defeat, after a Fox News Channel survey showed him down 32 percentage points on his rival. "Hell no, I'm not down 30 points," insisted David Perdue, whose campaign did not respond to requests for comment for this article. "We may not win on Tuesday," he added, "but I will guarantee you we are not down 30 points. The key threshold on Tuesday is 50%. Brian Kemp must win an outright majority in the five-candidate field to avoid a one-on-one runoff in June." The story of David Perdue's efforts is less one of political collapse and more of a failure to launch. From the moment he announced his candidacy in December, Mr. Perdue never demonstrated the same commitment to winning that he displayed in his first Senate race back in 2014. His case for ousting Brian Kemp was always largely based on support from the former president, Donald Trump. Mr. Perdue argued at his campaign introduction that the governor had so alienated the party's Trump faithful that they would not rally around Mr. Kemp against Stacey Abrams, the presumptive Democratic nominee and a leading villain for Republicans. But Mr. Perdue, a 72-year-old, a wealthy former chief executive of Dollar General, never came close to matching the $3.8 million of his own money he put into his 2014 Senate race. He invested just $500,000 in his bid for governor of Georgia. That is less than he and his wife spent last year for a waterfront lot on a secluded peninsula on scenic St. Simon's Island, a purchase made not long after his runoff defeat at the hands of a then 33-year-old Democrat that delivered Senate control to Democrats. A permit to build a nearly 12,000-square-feet mansion worth an estimated $5 million on land including over 625 feet of lake frontage, according to the listing, was granted 2 weeks after he declared his candidacy, according to records. Donald Trump has simultaneously invested heavily in Mr. Perdue with his $2.64 million and sought to avoid blame as the candidate has faltered, telling the New York Times in April that the news media's focus should be on the endorsements, not the David Perdue one, to measure his influence. Donald Trump's last rally in Georgia came in late March. He did not return to Georgia, as Perdue allies had hoped, instead holding a conference call for supporters in early May. "I am with David all the way because Brian Kemp was the worst governor in the country on election integrity," Donald Trump insisted on Friday on his Truth social messaging platform. David Perdue, like candidates for governor in Idaho and Nebraska this month, learned that a Trump endorsement does not assure the support of Trump voters or Trump donors. "The Trump endorsement is very important, but it's only an endorsement," said former Representative Jack Kingston, who lost the 2014 Senate primary to David Perdue and is a former Trump advisor. "It's not an army of infrastructure and door knockers the way it would be if you have the Sierra Club or the NRA or the AFL-CIO. The juxtaposition between the Kemp and Perdue camps was particularly stark on Friday. Mr. Kemp was outside Savannah, Georgia, announcing that Hyundai was investing $5.5 billion in an electric battery and vehicle manufacturing plant, one of the largest economic development projects in Georgia's history. David Perdue was nearby holding an endorsement event with Sarah Palin, the 2008 Republican vice presidential nominee, who is making her own comeback attempt in a House race in Alaska. "I would rather be standing on the stage announcing 7,500 jobs than standing next to Sarah Palin," said Brian Kemp's Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, a fierce Trump critic who opted not to run for re-election this year. Randy Evans, a Perdue supporter who served as ambassador to Luxembourg in the Trump administration, said the Kemp operation had been ruthless in using what he called the bullying powers of the governorship. Randy Evans' son, Jake, is running for Congress in the Atlanta suburbs. "When Kemp-aligned Republican legislators drew new lines in redistricting, the younger Mr. Evans was suddenly drawn out of the district in which he had been planning to run. They cut a sliver about the size of your little finger," the elder Mr. Evans said. "Jake had to move, buy a new house." Brian Kemp, a 58-year-old, leveraged the powers of incumbency in other crucial ways. He signed the measure to provide tax refunds of up to $500 for married couples, then announced on 11th of May, after early voting had begun, that those checks were in the mail. He appealed to rural Georgians by raising pay for teachers, and pleased conservatives by signing sweeping legislation to restrict voting access, to expand gun rights, and forbid school mask mandates. David Perdue's efforts could seem feeble in comparison. In March, he attacked Brian Kemp for recruiting an electric truck maker to open a factory in rural Georgia, creating thousands of jobs, because George Soros, the prominent Democratic donor, had recently invested in the company. The Kemp-Perdue contest was steeped in the drama of personal betrayal. Brian Kemp had spent weeks campaigning with David Perdue before the senator's defeat in the January 2021 Senate runoff election. By then, Brian Kemp had infuriated Donald Trump by defending the legitimacy of Georgia's presidential results. Last spring, Brian Kemp's aides said David Perdue assured Brian Kemp that he did not intend to run for governor. That June, Mr. Perdue introduced the governor at the Georgia Republican Party's annual convention. But Brian Kemp cannily had already begun the process of installing Sonny Perdue, a popular former governor, to run Georgia's state universities, an appointment that effectively put him on the sidelines. Sonny Perdue, through a spokesperson, declined to comment. Brian Kemp also preemptively secured the loyalty and fundraising might of Alec Poitvent, a South Georgia businessman who had served as campaign chairman for David Perdue's Senate campaigns and Sonny Perdue's campaigns for governor. One of many ways, the Brian Kemp operation boxed out David Perdue financially. Mr. Poitvent said he was among a host of longtime David Perdue supporters who had urged him not to run. Shunned by the state's political establishment, David Perdue tried framing himself as a political outsider. "I've been an outsider since I got into politics," he said on Thursday. But that is a difficult case to make for a former senator boasting of his support from a former president.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.